Greetings, listeners and friends of the RAOTC. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia, saying welcome to this broadcast for November 2021. I am Bruce, VK3UVN.
I am Ian, VK3JS, here to help present this program.
And together we hope you'll enjoy this bulletin of news and information. This broadcast is relayed on a number of frequencies on the first Monday of the month, except for January. The transmissions emanate from many different sources, and the actual times and frequencies may be found on our website www.raotc.org.au. Now I'd like to thank all of our volunteers who have helped with the relaying of this broadcast. Club News. Now we have two new members, and they are Jeff Hunt, VK5AC, previous call signs VK5JZH, VK0JZH, and VK5JH, and he became the full RAOTC member number 1825 on the 30th of September 2021. And also we have Russell Kelly, VK3NT, previous call sign VK3BAG, and he became new RAOTC life member number 1826 on the 13th of October 2021. And we welcome Jeff and Russell and hope that you'll enjoy your time with RAOTC. Now, we have been advised of a silent key, and it is Henry Curl Blythe, RAOTC member number 1654, and he became a silent key on the 30th of September at the age of 99. We pause for a few moments in memory of our departed colleague. Thank you. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now here are some articles. And the first one is from Ian, and he's going to present a short article for you.
Hello listeners, I hope you're all well and safe and happy. Today we're going to talk about the name Michael Faraday. I'd be surprised if you haven't heard of him. He's regarded by many as the father of modern electricity. And this is an article which goes back into electromagnetic history. We have all heard of the terms Faraday cage, the unit of capacitance, the farad, but where did this all come from? We now discuss Michael Faraday, who was born on the 22nd of September 1791 and died on the 25th of August 1867 at the age of 75. He was an English scientist who contributed to the study of electromagnetism and electrochemistry. His main discoveries include the principles underlying electromagnetic induction, diamagnetism, and electrolysis. He created the first transformer and the first electric generator, and he was partly responsible for coining many familiar words, including electrode, cathode, and ion, or eon, if you prefer that pronunciation. Faraday left school at the age of 13 to work as an errand boy. He was an institutional member of the Royal Society. Although Faraday received little formal education, he was one of the most influential scientists in history. It was by his research on the magnetic field around a conductor carrying a direct current that Faraday established the basis for the concept of the electromagnetic field in physics. Faraday also established that magnetism could affect rays of lights and that there was an underlying relationship between the two phenomena. He similarly discovered the principles of electromagnetic induction and diamagnetism and the laws of electrolysis. His inventions of electromagnetic rotary devices formed the foundation of electric motor technology, and it was largely due to his efforts that electricity became practical for use in technology. As a chemist, Faraday discovered benzene, investigated the clathrate hydrate of chlorine, inverted an early form of Bunsen burner and the system of oxidation numbers, and populated terminology such as anode, cathode, electrode, and ion. Faraday ultimately became the first and foremost Fullerian professor of chemistry at the Royal Institution, a lifetime position. He was an excellent experimentalist who conveyed his ideas in clear and simple language. His mathematical abilities, however, did not extend as far as trigonometry and were limited to the simplest algebra. James Clerk Maxwell took the work of Faraday and others and summarized them in a set of equations which are accepted as the basis for all modern theories of electromagnetic phenomena. On Faraday's uses of lines of force, Maxwell wrote that they show Faraday, quote, to have been in reality a mathematician of a very high order, one from whom the mathematicians of the future may derive valuable and fertile methods, end of quote. The SI unit of capacitance is named in his honour. Albert Einstein kept a picture of Faraday on his study wall alongside pictures of Isaac Newton and James Clerk Maxwell. Physicist Ernest Rutherford stated, quote, when we consider the magnitude and extent of his discoveries and their influence on the progress of science and industry, there is no honour too great to pay to the memory of Faraday, one of the greatest scientific discoverers of all time. End of quote. How fortunate for civilization that Beethoven, Michelangelo, Galileo, and Faraday were not required by law to attend schools where their total personalities would have been operated upon to make them learn acceptable ways of participating of members of the group. Michael Faraday was born on the 22nd of September 1791 at Newington Butts, which is now part of the London Borough of Southwark, but was then a suburban part of Surrey. His family was not well off. His father, James, was a member of the Glassite sect of Christianity. James Faraday moved his wife and two children to London during the winter of 1790 from Outgill in Westmoreland, where he had been an apprentice to the village blacksmith. Michael was born in the autumn of that year. The young Michael Faraday, who was the third of four children, having only the most basic school education, had to educate himself. At the age of 14, he became an apprentice to George Rebell, a local bookbinder and bookseller in Blandford Street. During his seven-year apprenticeship, Faraday read many books, including Isaac Watts' The Improvement of the Mind, and he enthusiastically implemented the principles and suggestions contained therein. He also developed an interest in science, especially in electricity. Faraday was particularly inspired by the book Conversations on Chemistry by James Marset. In 1812, at the age of 20, and at the end of his apprenticeship, Faraday attended lectures by the eminent English chemist Humphrey Davy of the Royal Institution and the Royal Society, and John Tatum, founder of the City Philosophical Society. Many of the tickets for these lectures were given to Faraday by William Dance, who was one of the founders of the Royal Philharmonic Society. Faraday subsequently sent Davy a 300-page book based on notes that he had taken during these lectures. Davy's reply was immediate, kind, and favourable. In 1813, when Davy damaged his eyesight in an accident with nitrogen trichloride, he decided to employ Faraday as an assistant. Coincidentally, one of the Royal Institution's assistant, John Payne, was sacked, and Sir Humphry Davy had been asked to find a replacement. Thus, he appointed Faraday as chemical assistant at the Royal Institution on the 1st of March, 1813. Very soon, Davy entrusted Faraday with the preparation of nitrogen trichloride samples, and they both were injured in an explosion of this very sensitive substance. Faraday married Sarah Barnard on the 12th of June, 1821. They met through their families at the Sandemanian Church, and he confessed his faith to the Sandemanian congregation the month after they were married. They had no children. Faraday was a devout Christian. His Sandemanian denomination was an offshoot of the Church of Scotland. Well after his marriage, he served as deacon and for two terms as an elder in the meeting house of his youth. His church was located at Paul's Alley in the Barbican. This meeting house relocated in 1862 to Barnsbury Grove, Islington, and this North London location was where Faraday served the final 2 years of his second term as elder prior to his resignation from that post. Biographers have noted that, quote, a strong sense of the unity of God and nature pervaded Faraday's life and work, end of quote. In June 1832, the University of Oxford granted Faraday an honorary doctorate of civil law. During his lifetime, he was offered a knighthood in recognition of his services to science, which he turned down on religious grounds, believing that it was against the word of the Bible to accumulate riches and pursue worldly reward, and stating that he preferred to remain plain Mr. Faraday to the end.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia.
Elected a member of the Royal Society of 1824, he twice refused to become president. He became the first Fullerian Professor of Chemistry at the Royal Institution in 1833. In 1832, he was elected a foreign honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was elected a foreign member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in 1838, and one of eight foreign members elected to the French Academy in 1844. In 1849, he was elected as associate member to the Royal Institute of the Netherlands, which 2 years later became the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences, and he was subsequently made a foreign member. Faraday suffered a nervous breakdown in 1839, but eventually returned to his investigations into electromagnetism. In 1848, as a result of representations by the Prince Consort, Faraday was awarded a grace and favour house in Hampton Court in Middlesex, free of all expenses and upkeep. This was a Master Mason's house, later called Faraday House, and now number 37 Hampton Court Road. In 1858, Faraday retired to live there. Having provided a number of various service projects for the British government, when asked by the government to advise on the production of chemical weapons for use in the Crimean War, Faraday refused to participate, citing ethical reasons. He died at his house at Hampton Court on the 25th of August, 1867. He had some years before turned down an offer of burial in Westminster Abbey upon his death. He has a memorial plaque there near Isaac Newton's tomb. Faraday was interred in the dissenters, that is non-Anglican section of Highgate Cemetery. So there you are, just a simple man who ended up making enormous contributions to the development of knowledge. Take care. Catch up with you again soon.
This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. As most of you have computers of some description, here is another computer historical item. It is entitled 35 Years of Microsoft Windows, Remembering Windows 1.0. Microsoft released Windows 1.0 on the 20th of November 1985, starting as an environment that ran on top of MS-DOS. Windows became the most popular desktop operating system in the world. Let's travel back in time and have a look at what the original Windows 1.1 was like. In the early 80s, the tech press regarded mouse-based graphical user interfaces, GUIs, and multitasking as the hot new thing. It was similar to the current craze over augmented reality and neural networks. At that time, the entire industry was aware of Xerox's work on the Alto computer at Park in the 1970s. A commercial version of that technology, the Xerox Star, had shipped in 1981. As personal computers improved in CPU speed and memory capability, it became possible for lower-cost machines to run GUIs, which dramatically improved user-friendliness. In 1983, Apple released its $10,000 mouse-based Apple Lisa computer. Meanwhile, less expensive IBM PC-based GUIs like the Visa On started to appear. The general trend towards GUIs in the industry prompted Microsoft to start working on an experimental precursor to Windows as early as 1981. However, the project formally launched a few years later, in 1983, and Windows was announced to the press. It took two more years and a new project manager, Tandy Trower, before a shippable product was created. Windows 1.01 launched in 1985, but when it finally shipped, it made few waves in the industry. However, that first version laid the foundation for the future of Microsoft. To use Windows 1.0 back in the day, you purchased a boxed copy of the software. Then you either installed it to a hard disk inside your PC or ran it from two floppy disks. Windows 1.1 wasn't a standalone operating system. Rather, it was a graphical application environment that ran on top of MS-DOS. Windows 1.0 supported CGA, Hercules, or EGA graphics. You could also use a number of mice that were on the market at the time, including Microsoft's. A mouse wasn't required though. Just as you can today, you can control Windows entirely with keyboard commands. After booting, if you wanted to launch Windows, you just type Win at the MS-DOS prompt. Windows 1.01 was the first public release version of Windows. Compared to the versions that followed, Windows 1.01 represented a fairly primitive graphical environment. It included a simple program launcher and file manager called MS-DOS Executive. This was a bare-bones list of the file names, with nary an icon to be seen. If you clicked an .exe file or in MS-DOS Executive, the program would open as an application window. You could maximize or minimize it using the zoom or icon functions, respectively. When minimized, an application was represented by an icon on a simple taskbar that stretched across the bottom of the screen. At any time, you could double-click an icon in the taskbar to open that window again. Windows 1.0 also included several basic applications, including calendar, clock, clipboard, card file, terminal, notepad, write, and paint. Notepad was suitably spartan in function, and paint-only supported monochrome graphics. The software also ran MS-DOS programs within a window, but few single-task DOS applications behave properly in this new multitask environment. Unlike later versions of Windows and the Mac operating system, Windows 1.0 didn't support overlapping windows. Instead, windows could only be tiled side by side on screen, and their contents would automatically resize to fit the available space. According to many Windows history websites, Microsoft made this decision to avoid similarities with Mac OS. However, according to Trower, it might have just been the preference of an earlier project manager, and there was no time to change it before shipping. While it's primitive by today's standards, Windows 1.0 was still an impressive start, considering the low-powered PCs that could run it at the time. It laid the groundwork for future expansion on the concept. Additionally, some of its innovations informed successful new Windows features later on, including the taskbar introduced on Windows 95. Windows 1.0 shipped with the first ever commercially published Windows game, Reversi. This strategy board game was programmed by Chris Peters at Microsoft just as an experimental exercise. However, it was later included in the Windows 1.0 release as part of a set of built-in applications. Reversi is based on Othello. It has four levels. Unfortunately, it's also brutally difficult. It didn't gain as many fans as later Windows gaming staples like Solitaire and Minesweeper. Nevertheless, Reversi did ship with Windows up to version 3.0 in 1990. Very few commercial games ever saw release for Windows 1.0. In fact, the only one we know of is Balance of Power, the geopolitical strategy game created by legendary designer Chris Crawford. This might make Balance of Power the official second Windows game, if you don't count the internal ones developed at Microsoft, like Puzzle and Chess. Over the next few years, developers released several shareware games for Windows, but you can count the total number on two hands. It's possible Windows didn't see another retail game release until 1991, Battle Chess for Windows 3.0. Windows 1.0 received a lukewarm response from the press when it launched. Having first been announced in 1983, most considered it 2 years late. Plus, other windowing systems for PCs and the Macintosh OS surpassed it in style and capabilities. In 1985, PC mice were also expensive accessories. Given the lack of applications available for Windows, there was also no killer app to drive adoption at that point. Even Microsoft's Word and Excel programs wouldn't ship with Windows for another year. Costs would have to come down and baseline PC system capabilities would have to rise before that could happen. Still, Windows 10 was a big step into a huge new product line, even if Microsoft didn't realize it at the time. Since then, we've seen at least a dozen major versions of Windows, from Windows 2.0 to Windows 10. And that's not even counting the offshoots, like the Windows XP Tablet Edition and the Windows Phone. Windows is still big business for Microsoft. It all started 35 years ago with Windows 1.1. Believe it or not, Microsoft continued to support the Windows 1.0 Standard Edition until December 31st, 2001, a full 16 years after its release, making it the longest supported version of Windows to date. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club of Australia. Now we come to the end of our session, and here is this month's joke. And it comes to us from Volker Pluger, VK2VP. Thanks, Volker. An elderly farmer in Queensland had owned a large property for several years. He had a dam in one of the lower paddocks, where he had planted mango and avocado trees. The dam had been set up for swimming when it was built, and he also had some picnic tables placed there in the shade of the fruit trees. One evening, the old farmer decided to go down to the dam to look it over, as he hadn't been there for a while. He grabbed a 10-litre bucket to bring back some fruit. As he neared the dam, he heard voices shouting and laughing. As he came closer, he saw it was four young women skinny-dipping in his dam. He made the women aware of his presence, and they all moved to the deep end. One of the women shouted to him, "We're not coming out until you leave." The old man frowned and said, "I didn't come down here to watch you ladies swim naked or make you to get out of the dam naked." Holding up the bucket, he said, "I'm just here to feed the crocodile." Thank you for listening. Ian and I hope you found something of interest. Next month we will present another article of computer historical interest. So until then, and all being well, we shall be back with you on Monday, the 6th of December, 2021. This is VK3OTN, the station of the Radio Amateurs Alzheimer's Club of Australia, saying 73, and listening now for any check-ins and callbacks for those relay stations that have an operator available. Thank you.